we continue to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the release of the film That Thing You Do. Tom Hanks' directorial debut opened in theaters on October 4th, 1996. Was not a big hit initially, but over time has grown into be, well, much more than a cult favorite, a beloved film that we celebrate whenever we get the chance here. And over at The Ringer, talented writer Jake Kring Schreifels talked to just about everybody involved in the production to produce a wonderful oral history. And we had a chance to talk a couple of days ago with Jake about That Thing You Do. Jake, thank you so much for being with us. I loved your oral history of That Thing You Do. It's always been one of my favorite movies. What drew you to it?
Well, I had mentioned on social media when I posted this article, I grew up in Seattle for most of my life, and I remember distinctly my music teacher in elementary school pulling in the TV, and it must have been at some point at the end of the year when not a lot was going on, and she specifically decided we needed to watch That Thing You Do as a fourth grade class. And so I think we spent a couple days spreading it out and watching the whole movie. And ever since then, it just stuck with me. I probably convinced my parents to go to Blockbuster and so we could watch it again. But, you know, as a little kid, you start to cling on to something and then you naturally want to see the thing over and over again. And so that was a lot of my movie watching experience as a kid. And so from there, it then turned into a greater appreciation as I got older about what was actually happening in the movie, the talent of the performances, Tom Hanks's direction, the writing, the music, obviously. I had a greater perspective once I started to engage and start writing about movies, but it really just continued to blossom for me. So it started as kind of an innocent music teacher offering this to a class, and continued to grow in my appreciation ever since.
All right. First of all, you had the coolest fourth grade teacher of all time.
I did. She knew what she was doing.
That's wonderful. Well, you have talked to just about everybody associated with the film, and we've had a chance, as I told you, to talk to a few of the guys, but what I found is this, and clearly you did by talking to so many people, is that they all love this experience and look back on it fondly 25 years later as not just a terrific film, but as one of the more enjoyable filmmaking moments that most of them have had.
Yeah, I remember when I started my first interview with Tom Everett Scott, who plays Guy Patterson, and I almost had to apologize to him at the beginning and then just say, look, I know you have talked about this movie ad nauseum over your career, and I just wanted to let you know that I'm going to ask some different questions here, and you know, just trying to make sure that he knew that I wasn't going to just do the same old kind of 5-minute questions. And he just stopped me and he said, no, look, just so you know, this is one of the greatest experiences of my life. I love talking about it. And that really set the tone for this project for me, because it really was, as you mentioned, it echoed so much of what everyone else told me about this, that to this day, people come up to them and all they want to do and is talk about That Thing You Do, aside from maybe all of the other amazing credits in their filmography. So the experience, what I found was that it did very much match the enthusiasm of the fans and the feel-good nature of this movie. And, you know, not always is that the case when you're looking at these kinds of movies. There are some times where maybe an actor or a writer or an editor doesn't have the same optimism or excitement about something when it's in production. But as I quickly learned talking to so many people, it was across the board pretty even in terms of what they got out of it and what people got out of it.
Well, it's fascinating to learn from your oral history that Tom Hanks had been thinking about making a movie about this time period and the music business for a while, but it was really when he was on the set of Forrest Gump that he sat down and came up with the treatment for it.
Yeah, I wasn't sure really the origins. I had not, and I think that was part of my interest in wanting to do this project too, as someone who loves this movie so much. I had heard lots of interviews with the cast, but I don't think Tom had really talked too much about some of his inspiration for this movie, just aside from here and there saying, oh, I like one-hit wonders, or I love 1960s music. But yeah, Forrest Gump, I think, was a big part of it for him. He mentioned to me, and he made it clear, you know, he could have sounded a little bit arrogant by saying, "Oh, I'm so tired of working on movies and being part of press tours, and so I just needed some other creative outlet to keep me going." But he did mention, you know, when you are in the throes of doing these Oscar-nominated movies and you are always doing press for things and talking about yourself in this way that's related to awards, that it does get a little bit frustrating and it can become tiresome. And so this movie and this inspiration for him really was a way to kind of combat that and create this other creative outlet for him that he could really focus on and kind of use to balance out some of the awards posturing that he was doing throughout the early 1990s. And it really is a remarkable run that he had. If you think about Forrest Gump, Philadelphia, and Apollo 13 coming out all in a row, and that is an incredible, prolific kind of spurt that he had in his career. And so then to follow that up with his own smaller project, I think it kind of makes sense in the way that his career arc was going, that I think he wanted something smaller, maybe something a little bit more devoted just to his vision that would make more sense to him in terms of what his life was at that moment, which was just constantly jetting around the world promoting himself.
Putting the band together was obviously crucial, and you learned that it was Steve Zahn that really was the first of the Wonders to be cast, and he just blew everybody away when he did his audition.
Yeah, I didn't know that, and it was interesting talking to Jonathan Demme, the famous director who recently passed away. His assistant I spoke with, and she had mentioned the fact that there was this real desire by him to do a table reading. That was one of his big ideas, and he loved doing those for his other movies. It was a way to hear the screenplay just out loud and in the flow of things. And so when they decided to do this table read in New York, they had, I believe Meredith Tucker, one of the casting agents, had heard about Steve Zahn through his small theater company that he had done with Ethan Hawke. And so they even brought Ethan Hawke to do this table read. And it wasn't an audition. Steve Zahn really had no idea who was going to be there. He was pretty surprised when Tom Hanks shows up at the table read. So imagine you're an actor and you just get a call from your agent. "Hey, can you read this for us? It's just a screenplay from some no-name." And he goes in, and then all of a sudden he's surprised to find Tom Hanks there. And he said, I was glad I did a little preparation for it. And it turned out he did way more than enough because, yeah, he just stole the entire energy of the room. Just everyone was laughing. And I think Tom Hanks even went up to him afterward and kind of offered the idea of like, "Hey, we really like you for this." And I don't even think Steve took it seriously at first because he just thought this was something that wasn't even going to be a real project and maybe happen a couple years down the road. And then things really spiraled quickly, and he got a call pretty soon and got offered the part. So yeah, it was funny. He really captured this role from day one.
We're talking with Jake Kring Schreifels from The Ringer about his oral history of That Thing You Do. Jonathan Scheck, one of the things that may have landed the role of Jimmy for him was a line reading and the way he decided to sing the words "I quit" rather than just read them off the page.
That's right. Yeah, I found that to be pretty cool because so much of what he is remembered for most in That Thing You Do is his iconic "I quit" scene when he goes up to the microphone and starts to sing in front of Mr. White. And to learn that he did that in the audition is pretty cool. But then to learn that he was the only one that even thought of that idea, I think it proves and shows just sometimes how much that an actor can really benefit by really thinking a little bit greater than just what's written on the page. And sometimes these oral histories are good windows into an actor's mindset and how they approach auditions. And that's something that I found that to be really interesting as I've done some of these projects in the past, is just how do you differentiate yourself? Because as he mentioned, there were a lot of young guys, and you know, some were famous, some, you know, Ed Norton, Billy Crudup, I think those guys had also auditioned. There were probably plenty of other names that Tom Hanks and some others probably refused to tell me just for their own benefit. But I think you know, when you look at a long list of audition people that are coming up, and they all look the same as you, and they all seem like they're reading the same lines, just a little wrinkle like that. And he had also come fully dressed too, which also set him apart. So the little things like that that can really distinguish you helped him in a big way during that day.
And they all liked Tom Everett Scott, but there were some concerns that he looked a little bit too much like Tom Hanks.
Yeah, there was. And, you know, I talked to Ed Saxon about that too, one of the producers. And he mentioned for a long time, Hollywood had always wondered, okay, who's going to be the next Jimmy Stewart? Who was going to be that guy? And Tom Hanks ended up kind of being someone that people thought was that generation's Jimmy Stewart. And so then as Tom Hanks goes throughout his career, he's got this movie he's helming, and you start to think, okay, is he just picking somebody that's going to be his likeness? Is he almost taking over the role, even though he's not going to be playing it? And I think that was maybe weighing on his mind as he was casting. He had a good amount of people that he liked, but nothing he felt was really, really strong for Guy Patterson. But he really liked Tom Everett Scott, and I think that was his major qualm, was just, I think he looks too much like me. And luckily enough, Rita Wilson, his wife, went over and looked at the tape and just said, Tom, come on, this guy is incredible. You can't not cast him just because he kind of has, you have this one little idea that he might be considered by the press to be a young Tom Hanks. So she finally convinced him to give him another shot. And I think that really kind of started to spark the idea in him that, you know, this was the right choice, to go with his gut, even though he felt like there might be some criticism later down the road.
I like Tom Hanks' description of Ethan Embry as an odd dude.
Yes, he is. I tried to coax out. I was wondering if he actually specifically remembered Ethan's audition, because Ethan came in and had his bass guitar tagged up with so many stickers and some maybe not safe for work stickers, I'll put it like that. And it kind of set the tone for the way that he acted on set. He was only 16, and, you know, as a young teenager who's into the punk rock phase, he, you know, painted his nails, he dyed his hair at one point during the production. He was a bit of a troublemaker, and it's funny because you don't necessarily think that just looking at him in that movie, he would be the guy. He's obviously playing a character that's kind of anonymous and doesn't really say a lot. So you don't have a great deal of character to work off of, but he was pretty much the opposite. He did very eccentric things. And so I think Tom was really just it was an effort by everyone on set, including Tom Hanks, to kind of rein him in, make sure he was on set. You know, he couldn't go out to drink with the guys, but he was, as he mentioned to me, he would go home and smoke weed a lot. So he was very much into the counterculture of the 90s at that point, but you wouldn't have guessed it just watching him.
And Tom Hanks' biggest advice for the guys who played the Wonders was just be on time. And they did that with one notable exception.
Yeah, I mean, it was a good learning opportunity for a lot of those actors, because they're all pretty much in their late teens, early 20s at that point. Some of them were greener than others in their careers, but when you work with Tom Hanks, you've kind of reached it in terms of what you want to do as an actor. And I think he gave them that advice: be on time, know your lines. And they, three of them, Tom Everett Scott distinctly remembers him, Steve Zahn and John Cech showing up late, and I believe it was for the Mercyhurst college talent show scene. And Gary Getzman came over to them and huddled them up and told them, Tom is very disappointed in you. And I think they all kind of got that real sense of shame that they had done something they should not have. And so then Tom Hanks's words really started to become accentuated when that happened. And it was funny because as I talked to Ethan and some of the others too, it did seem like Gary Getzman, who really is the co-brain of this movie, and unfortunately I was not able to speak with him, but he did kind of seem to be the protector of them. He was the first front line, so to speak, in front of Tom, so that Tom didn't have to go out of his way to scold everyone or be the consequence enforcer in some respects. So they learned their lesson pretty quickly during that shoot, and it's really stuck with them ever since.
One of my favorite stories in your oral history is how Holmes Osborne ended up getting the part of Mr. Patterson.
Yes. Yes, he found it through a newspaper ad, or at least a newspaper clipping that Tom Hanks was going to be making this movie. And the funny thing about Holmes is he is such an old-fashioned guy. He lives outside of Kansas City, Missouri to this day. And I think when he was working with Tom Hanks back in their Great Lakes Shakespeare days in the 70s, you know, he really developed a great friendship with him. And I think that was tough because in some respects, he never really had the Hollywood career that Tom did after that early theatrical training. And so when he sees this opportunity, and as he's, you know, aged as an actor, it just kind of was a nice anecdote, I thought, to share about the way that Tom Hanks is as a person, that he would respond so quickly to this old friend of his from his theater days and say, "You've got this role." And it was funny. I don't think I mentioned this, but Holmes was a little bit concerned that, you know, Tom didn't really know too much about his acting besides some of their early days. But apparently Tom Hanks had seen him play a very small part in this movie called Truman. And that was more than enough for him to get the role of Mr. Patterson. So it's just so funny how life can kind of find these connections for you, and you don't really know what it will, you know, hold in store until you just make a request. And that was the case right there for Holmes.
The movie doesn't work unless the music is not only good, but believable and can work for that time period, but also be hummable in the late 1990s as well. Can you talk a little bit about the contributions of, obviously, the late Adam Schlesinger and the lead vocalist, Mike Viola?
Yeah, Adam Schlesinger, just an incredible musician, songwriter, and, you know, the tributes really poured in last year when we found out about him dying, passing away from COVID. And I think it was really important that I spend some time really exploring this movie's music, just to kind of give his legacy a little bit more of a touch of you know, what he meant to this movie, I guess I should say. I think, you know, he was able to do an interview a few years ago that I used some excerpts from, just talking about the creative process on this song. And he was somebody that was very interested in pop culture and wanting to write songs for a variety of different things. He had just signed a recording contract with PolyGram and had some friends with Tom Hanks who told him about this project. And so that was what initially spurred him on to do this. And the interesting part of this story that I hadn't really known, and I don't think had been known too much, was that Mike Viola, who does all the lead vocals for this movie, was pretty reticent about doing this with Adam. Adam was a good friend of his, but Mike had been through a tough time. He had just lost his wife. She had passed away. He was in a dark place. He came to New York and stayed with Adam, and they developed this good bond there, but Adam was having to convince Mike to sing with him on this song, and so eventually he did. They recorded it. They had another producer, Annie Chase, who really created this whole Beatles vibe with them. They did Beatles chords. They went to the studio in New York and tried to set up the studio to be in mono instead of stereo, just like the Monkees or other 1960s bands would do. So they created this sound, and it was kind of like I mentioned with John Chick, trying to get into character, trying to sing and dress the part. It felt like very much as though this demo that they sent in to the That Thing You Do production team was a lot more tailored to what they were looking for, that 1960s bright Beatles and Beach Boys sound. And so really a collaborative effort there. And eventually Mike Viola did have to get more convincing to do most of the other songs, because once you have his voice in it, you can't have another singer to be Jimmy. So Gary Getzman really did have to convince him to take part in this soundtrack. And I think after a while, Mike Viola realized the importance of this to the movie. But it was really a monumental effort that they were able to pull this off, because that song is so important to this movie, and it really has to be played. I think it's probably played 7 or 8 times throughout the movie, which is hard to do and also still be excited about it. But they do it in so many different ways and diversify the songs that it really does still capture you to this day.
You know, 25 years later, we forget that the movie was not a box office smash, by any stretch, but it seems 25 years later, it's more popular, more beloved than ever. What's the secret to the legs that that thing you do has?
You know, Ethan Embry told me that he thought, and I think it's a good point, he thought that most movies that have this phenomenon happen to them, where they don't get the initial attraction, don't get the initial box office receipts, I think because of that, so many people feel as though they personally have found this movie. Yeah, especially in the late 90s and early 2000s, when there's not the internet and there's not social media. If you came across this movie, chances were you didn't really hear about it too much anywhere else, and it wasn't a mainstream offer. You probably saw Tom Hanks and were interested. And I think so many people, millennials especially, younger kids like me who found it through their music teacher, at a time in their life when they were very impressionable, when they loved music, I think a lot of that generation now has come of age in social media era, and they've now decided, wow, like, nobody has heard of this movie. I loved this. And they start to find this community of people that also shared the same thoughts. And so I think that's sort of what happened here, is there was, for a long time, not many people knew too much about this other group of people that also loved the movie the same way they did, until social media allows them to connect and see, with hashtags, with anniversaries like this one, that there is this growing fan base. And I mean, it's so understandable to see why people love this movie, and there's lots of ways into it. I've asked just about everybody that I talked to why they thought it was so beloved, and each person gave me a different answer. But I do think that it was that weird time where there wasn't all that interconnectivity, until you start to realize later in this later part of the decade that there's a lot of people that have the same ideas about it.
Well, if you love That Thing You Do, go to theringer.com and check out Pure Nostalgia, the oral history of That Thing You Do by Jake Kring Schreifels. Jake, I loved it. Some wonderful new discoveries about the film, and tremendous work. And thanks so much for talking with us about it.
Oh, I'm so glad you loved it, and thanks so much for having me on. I appreciate it.